Utah Writing Program and English Department in Composition, Creative Writing. And before that was an instructor at the Waterford School teaching ninth and tenth grade English. I've known Julie for several years, from back in the days when we were both students at BYU, and occasionally since then. I find her rather delightful to be with, and I'm sure paper will be a good experience for all of us. Julie also has published in the English Journal, Sunstone, The Exponent 2, Catalyst, Mormon Woman's Forum, and Bell's Letters. And she says, just like Don Hall Anderson in the symposium program, Julie is the author of many unpublished books, articles, and brilliant theses. In truth, she is working right now on her dissertation, which is a collection of short stories and a novella, and she says to watch for it. She is also the mother of four children and married to Jeff Nichols. She lives in Provo, Utah, and she adds, much to her surprise, I don't know if it's a surprise to be married to Nick or living in Provo, but that will go on. Philip Snyder. Philip says he wanted to be a cowboy. But while he was living in Fullerton, California, during his sophomore year in high school, decided that he would choose the next best thing, which was English. And also while he was a sophomore, he met and started dating his future wife, Lou Ann. And after dating for 3 years, which he says dated pretty heavily, she waited for him while he went on a mission to France and Belgium. They have three children. Professor Snyder received his master's in English from BYU in 1980. He received his PhD from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, where he actually met Michael Jordan. I don't know. And before coming to BYU, he was assistant professor at Niagara University in New York, where he says he didn't meet any famous people, but he did see the falls several times. At BYU, Philip Snyder teaches 20th century British and American literature and studies in autobiography. He is currently doing research in post-structuralist study of Kunstroman, or artist novel. Most recently, he is English Society advisor, producer and writer of Beowulf the Musical. He has published papers for Sunstone magazine, and under the auspices of the National Endowment for the Humanities in 1990 at the summer seminar at LSU, with James Olney, gave the seminar on forms of autobiography. We will now hear Julie presenting her paper, Like a Lover, Like a Warrior.
A few years ago, Melody Minch Charles gave a symposium paper protesting the Mormon concept of a heaven filled with male gods administering over their wives and children, who exist only to add to those males' glory. She's right when she says that wishing, hoping, and needing won't make heaven what I want it to be. But she is also right to go ahead and protest an official version of heaven that feels uncomfortable to her. Colleen McDaniel, who will be speaking in a day or two, points out that the ways in which people imagine heaven tell us how they understand themselves, their families, their society, and their God. Heaven is not merely a collection of idle fantasies, a projection of human hopes, or a reflection of religious doctrine. Our notions of heaven are not only the key to the deepest mysteries of religion, but a key to our culture. Wishing, hoping, and needing may not change the reality of heaven, but it may help explore or it may help expose the need for a shift in the way we perceive of it here on earth. And of course, it may be true that reality and perception are more nearly the same thing than we have been willing to admit. In current Mormon doctrine, service is the key to heaven. The amount of service you give, whether you're a man or a woman, whether the service is compassionate or temple or missionary, determines your worthiness for heaven. Now, service has always been the domain of the feminine. In spite of masculine gods and masculine authority, followers of organized Christianity have always had the role of woman-wife, as defined by materialist feminist Christine Delphi. She says, "I use the expression woman-wife to stress that the one is a person, woman, and the other a role, wife." This ontological distinction is blurred by the fact that the social role is so widely associated with a biological category that they have become equivalent. Housework, she says, is all the work done unpaid for others within the confines of the household of the family. Delphi's materialist analysis of woman's oppression does not take up the question of heaven. That's not the usual domain of Marxist analyses of anything. But Delphi does give us some terms by which to talk about this feminization of religious service. The institutionalized church is the bride of Christ, see Revelations 21 and 22, and the work of those within its fold has always been service, unpaid work for others within the confines of the household of the faithful. A turning to religion is always a turn away from the conventionally masculine economy of capitalism, where money is exchanged for goods of comparable value, because the payment for charitable work cannot be accounted in usual terms, and remuneration is deferred until another life. Although the giver of service may have a feeling of rest and peace, daily growing deeper, she receives no tangible good in exchange for services rendered. The actual reward of reunification with loved ones and God in heaven is promised at another time in the future. Heaven, in fact, is the deferred goods for services rendered now. Well, this is an economy of heaven familiar to Mormons, and it is illustrated graphically in a novel called Four Girls at Cottage City, written in 1898 by a black American woman, Emma D. Kelly Hawkins. Why should we refer to a novel that isn't Mormon and may not have been widely read by Mormon women? I'll be contrasting the images of heaven in this novel, so similar to Mormon images of heaven, with those in a 1985 novel by French feminist Monique Wittig. Fiction, I think, is useful in clarifying ideas because it provides images and stories whose meaning is understood in a different way than argument is understood. And because, as a self-conscious cultural construct, fiction reflects the norms of its time. Four Girls at Cottage City was part of a late 19th century reformist movement, which engendered the writing of much more radical literature than this particular novel. In itself, the novel is sentimental and in some places preachy, but it reflects one tenet of that feminist movement as urgent in that day as organizing against lynching, rape, and disenfranchisement. That was the mission of spiritual uplift, alternately termed spiritual feminism or domestic feminism. In fact, one of the most popular arguments of the 19th century held that only the elevation of the spirit can obliterate injustice. And in actuality, this sounds pretty familiar to us as 20th century Mormons as well. The novel is replete with economic images. Several young people are on a vacation from their labors when they meet an impoverished laundress named Charlotte Hood and her crippled son, Robin. They all become fast friends, and eventually the young people collect enough money to pay for an operation that heals Robin's physical problems. This is quintessential service, goods given freely for someone else with no hope of tangible reward. The young people are also spoken of as mortgaged to their landlords, an old couple who ask them repeatedly to sing "Nearer, My God, to Thee." The text thus posits the service of these young people as a kind of goods in the Christian economy, the payment for which will eventually be nearness to God, but only eventually. Mrs. Hood has a dream which describes her vision of this payment. She sees herself as part of a long procession of people moving toward a throne. It's kind of a Living Scriptures rendition of Doctrine and Covenant 76. The figure that sat on the throne, she says, was more beautiful than I can tell. It was clothed in a robe of rich crimson and gold, and on the noble head was a crown sparkling with the most precious stones. One after another to take his place before the throne and receive his reward, and I noticed as each one turned away, their faces expressed either great joy or deep woe. As Hester, this is a friend of Mrs. Hood's, knelt before the throne, he who sat in the chair leaned over and with his own royal hands raised her from the ground, and in the sweetest voice I had ever heard or dreamed of said, "Thou good and faithful servant, enter now into the joy of thy Lord." Now, this does sound familiar to us. He cast over her a robe of snowy whiteness, and on her head he put a plain gold crown. Listen to the kinds of rewards she's receiving. Taking his own crown off, he took from it a pearl of great size and beauty and placed it in Hester's crown. Mrs. Hood says, "It was now my turn. I did not dare to look into his face as I bowed myself before him. When, wonder of wonders, I felt myself raised so firmly yet so tenderly that I burst into tears of joy and wonder. 'My poor wandering child,' he said, in a voice like music, 'come with me.' Like a flash, the scene changed. The great white throne had disappeared, and all the beautiful, dazzling forms. I lifted my eyes timidly to him, And instead of the robe of crimson and gold, I saw he had on one of white. There was no crown upon his head. He gazed down upon me with eyes full of love, but he gently put me away from him. Sometime, my daughter, but not now. Thou hast not proven thyself worthy. I can never express the feeling of sorrowful humiliation that I felt when I heard these words. But my heart took courage at the word sometime. Well, you can hear that the reward of her service, or her lack of service, is imaged in monetary terms. Jewels, goods, beautiful things. And if the service hasn't been acceptable, it becomes like the worst kind of domestic work. Unpaid, unaccounted, remunerated only on an indefinitely deferred note. But in Monique Wittig's 1985 novel, Across the Acheron, women's service is seen as something very different. This novel is also a dream, a metaphor in progress. Hell is imaged as the suffering of women at the hands of men, and paradise is the victory over that suffering. The river Acheron flows solidified black and yellow tears. Scythe blades whir across desert sands toward Wittig. Mechanical eagles threaten to scar her with their talons. Chained and mutilated women march in a deadly parade before her eyes. In protest against these and other images of sterility and suffering, Wittig leaps from her privileged place in an attempt to aid the women she sees. One definition of service is one of a nation's organized fighting forces. Wittig is provided with a rifle, whips, and other weapons with which to protect herself and to cut down the enemy as he exploits and maims the damned women. The young people in Cottage City, in the other novel, accept Robin's undeserved suffering even as they mourn it. But Wittig furiously rejects the suffering she sees and actively seeks to alleviate the pain of the women who are marching across the Acheron. However, the women don't understand what she's doing, and this also sounds familiar to us, and they resist her efforts in their behalf. She turns to her guide, who is named Manastabal, and she cries, "I despise their servility." According to Webster, servility means a condition of, relating to, or appropriate to slaves, who are unpaid servants. Befitting a condition befitting a slave or a servant, unsuitable for a free person. Subject to a master or owner, behaving like a slave, hence lacking moral worth or dignity. Wittig tells her guide that she hasn't the slightest understanding of servility. "I would vomit it out if I could," she says. In contrast to that hell, paradise beckons. Wittig is allowed 6 glimpses of heaven before she is allowed to enter. And, of course, this corresponds to the 7 circles of paradise in Dante's Paradiso. They follow a fascinating progress, these 6 circles of heaven. At first, Wittig is impressed by the gentleness of the breezes, the texture of the air, and the femaleness of the angels. They all have vulvas. Also, as she becomes aware of the physical reality of paradise, she learns that words to describe it do not exist. There is such an absence of words that it turns the sky into blue ice. This will be important to remember when we come to Kristeva in a moment. As Wittig progresses from paradise to paradise, she makes more direct contact with the angels. One in particular, called Her Who Is My Providence, appears, escorted by other angels. She is separated from Wittig by a transparent barrier, and it isn't until the next circle that the barrier is broken and Wittig can name the angels. Then she must wrestle her providence in sustained silence. And Manastabal, her guide, says afterwards, "You took her to be the only angel you know," suggesting that she was not who Wittig thought she was. This angel that she wrestled was not who Wittig thought she was. So who was she, of course, becomes our question. In an essay entitled La Mystérique, French feminist Luce Irigaray suggests that God, in quotes, will prove to have been the best lover of the female mystic, since he separates her from herself only by that space of her jouissance or her pleasure where she finds him and herself. At present, says Irigaray, that pleasure is still hemmed in by representation, by language. Wittig's paradise refuses all representation. Language cannot encompass it. In it, she approaches more and more nearly her providence, the angel of herself, the God of this journey. An archaic meaning of the verb to serve is to pay a lover's or suitor's court to. Certainly, Vatigue not only serves the cause of oppressed women and seeks to give them release, but she also seeks to find her own best lover, the woman who is her providence, her savior. Perhaps the most moving and startling quality of the seventh and final manifestation of paradise is that it is a kitchen. One more definition of to serve. Listen, it's wonderful. One more definition of to serve is to help persons to food, to wait at table, to set out portions of food or drink. This is the substance of the very last section of the entire book. The angels, arriving on motorcycles, dismount on the site. They're all female, remember this. While in the fields, others are heard singing, "Soup of the evening, beautiful soup." In the middle of the esplanade, there is an open-air kitchen around which angels come and go, carrying various utensils, saucepans, buckets, vats, stoves, dishes, skimmers, basting spoons, forks and ladles, cleavers, choppers, knives, etc., etc. Angel musicians grouped under the arbutus trees and the sea pines play the clarinet, the piano, the saxophone and percussion. Boats can be seen in the port. All kinds of birds traverse the scene, some only in transit, others lingering and frolicking there. Their concert mingles with the music and serene speech of the angels. The food is to be cooked, put on the fire, boiled, roasted, grilled. There are ovens, furnaces, spits, grills, braziers full of charcoal. Some of the angels have their sleeves rolled up. Their faces are crimson. Fragrant dill, cumin, oregano, thyme, and rosemary are burnt in great dry bundles. Now angels pass, carrying baskets and bowls of fruit on their shoulders. Then they arrange them in the center of the courtyard in geometric piles. There are cherries, strawberries, raspberries, apricots, peaches, plums, tomatoes, avocados, green melons, cantaloupes. At a given moment, a bare-breasted cherub sounds the trumpet to announce that all is ready for the angel's kitchen. That is the last line, the last vision we have of this entire novel. And you can see how different it is from the earlier 19th century vision of heaven. Like Melody Minch Charles, Vatigue rejects the idea of a heaven where women are second class. She replaces it with one where women, women's tools, women's activities, women's relationships reign supreme. It is sensory, tangible, immediate. It is the consequence of warrior-like and lover-like service. So why don't we just drop the traditional Mormon 19th century idea and adopt this one? Well, aside from the fact that I don't think the brethren would be inclined to make that passage that I just read, section 141 in the Doctrine and Covenants, there is another good reason, it seems to me. And that is that this heaven is for adult women only. There are neither men nor children in this heaven. All women, I think, have had moments when such a place really does sound like heaven indeed. But I think we can safely say that the current question in women's issues now is not whether women should or can work outside the home or how far they can go in the marketplace, but whether they need husbands and children. The need for sex is never questioned. But thanks to reproductive technology, which renders unnecessary the presence of a male for the joining of sperm and egg, the question of whether to have children at all has become the question of issue for women of our time. I'm especially concerned, and you're laughing, but I really am concerned about an attitude that I see more and more in my students, my women students at BYU. They say, why should we want children when we know that having children will trap us into kinds of service that lead us into no status and no remuneration? Why should we want to go to a heaven where for women it's all children and no rest? That's Melody Minch Charles's heaven. On the other side of the coin, we're also seeing many single women and lesbians seeking to have children by whatever means. One reading of Doctrine and Covenants, section 132, suggests that eternal lives means eternal generations, which sounds so much like eternal children that many of us decry the whole notion as fervently as we decry the notion of unpaid service as our sole role in life. But Julia Kristeva, a feminist theorist, points out that an increasing number of women not only consider their maternity compatible with their professional life or their feminist involvement, but also indispensable to their discovery not of the plenitude, but of the complexity of the female experience, with all that this complexity comprises in joy and pain. I believe that this is true for many, if not most of us, even those of us who consider ourselves feminists. If we want to have eternal lives, but we don't want eternal pregnancy, if we do long for children, but not for eternal servility, what are we as good Mormon feminists to do? Well, Julia Kristeva, whom I have just quoted, is a Bulgarian psychoanalyst and linguist whose theories suggest a very strong answer for me. If fiction can aid us by creating and reflecting images from our culture, feminist theory can also aid us, it seems to me, by providing us with reasoned thought and arguments to answer the pressing questions of our hearts. Kristeva is an heir to the structuralists, the pioneers of language study who point out that the language is arbitrary. It is a systematic construction based on the notion of the sign, which is made of two parts, the signifier on the one hand, the word itself, and the signified, the thing the word stands for. The symbolic nature of the sign lies in its arbitrariness. That is, a word substitutes for a thing, but there is not necessarily a natural connection between the word and the thing. It is a learned connection. So for Kristeva, the symbolic, and she uses this word in kind of a special way, the symbolic is language itself, the separation of word from thing, of fact from notion. According to Kristeva, the essential moment in the formation of any psyche, male or female, is the process of learning the symbolic function. That is, the essential moment in the formation of any psyche is the entry into language. By symbolic function, she goes on to say, we mean a system of signs which are organized into structures whose aim is to accredit social communication as exchange purified of pleasure. From the beginning, we are dealing with a training process, an inhibition, which fully asserts itself with language learning. But this is not necessarily the ultimate goal of the psyche or soul. Kristeva goes on to say, the symbolic order functions in our monotheistic West by means of a system of kinship that involves transmission of the name of the father and a rigorous prohibition of incest, and a system of speech that involves an increasingly logical, simple, positive, and scientific form of communication, stripped of all stylistic, rhythmic, and poetic ambiguities. Such an order brings this inhibition, constitutive of the speaking animal, to a height never before attained, one logically assumed by the role of the father. So you see here Kristeva is equating denotative language and codified meaning with father law. She says there is no time without speech. There is no time without the father. That is what the father is, sign and time. The role of the mother includes not only the drives, but also the first training of these drives, marked by rhythms, intonations, and gestures, those things that are programmed out when we enter into language. She says, it is understandable that what the father doesn't say, what sign and time repress, appears as a certain kind of truth outside time, which neither judges nor postulates. It refuses, displaces, and breaks the symbolic order before it can reestablish itself. Let me paraphrase for just a minute. What she's saying is that the breaking of the symbolic order, when we step outside of the symbolic, that is the moment of potential transformation. Before and between moments of symbolic codification of meaning and rigidification of law is a space Kristeva calls the borderline. She says this is a pervasive aspect of the human condition. The borders of the symbolic are where art or certain types of art emerge. Now remember, she's using symbolic to mean language, linear, denotative language. The borders of the symbolic are where art or certain types of art emerge. To insist on the primacy of language is to fail to account for pre-verbal and non-verbal elements. And then she says, she names this, the semiotic dimension of experience. So we have another word that she uses in a special way, the semiotic. According to Kristeva, once the symbolic is entered, once an individual learns language, the only way she can protect herself against psychosis is through resumption of the functioning characteristic of the semiotic, that which is pre or outside of language. In other words, though it is necessary to make the fall into language and time, to remain so is to become eternally subject to father law, unforgiven without the possibility of repentance or change. Now, remember that Kristeva is a psychoanalyst. According to her definition, psychoanalysis is an infinite quest for rebirths through the experience of love, which is begun again only to be displaced, renewed, collected, and set up at the heart of the analysand's ulterior life as an auspicious condition for his perpetual renewal, his non-death. The chief method, that's the end of the quote, the chief method by which the psychoanalyst aids the psyche in this quest is to allow it to return to the semiotic, to allow it to go back to the borderline space, jidification and codification. To embrace signifying practices which are analytically unthinkable, in other words, outside the realm of language and father law, allows change and growth and transformation, which are, of course, the founding principles of eternal lives. Such a return to the semiotic, Kristeva says, is precisely what artistic practices, and notably poetic language, demonstrate. Poetic language is one legitimization of a type of language that would otherwise be considered psychotic. Poetry, of course, we don't run around saying in normal language, but when it's set down as poetry, it's all right. It's legitimized. The other legitimization of the return to the state outside codified meaning is, of course, the prelingual child, which is beloved and cared for tenderly as it grows toward its entry into the symbolic. Performing this nurturing function, quote, leads the mother into the labyrinths of an experience that without the child she would only rarely encounter. Love for an other. The slow, difficult, and delightful apprenticeship in attentiveness, gentleness, forgetting oneself. The ability to succeed in this path without masochism and without annihilating one's affective, intellectual, and professional personality. Such would seem to be the stakes to be won through guiltless maternity. It then becomes a creation in the strong sense of the term. End of quote. In her essay, Women's Time, Kristeva redefines the word generation. She says it is a signifying space, a both corporeal and desiring mental space. This is a wonderful way, I think, to think of eternal generations. As eternal progression, eternal learning and understanding and assimilation and transformation, eternal willingness to return to the space before and outside of codified meaning. Perhaps eternal generations means eternal rebirths, eternal returning to the semiotic, the place before meaning and law are rigidified. Whatever leads to this return, including the process of mothering, leads to heaven. What if we revise our notion of service and say that we serve like lovers when we are in the semiotic or allowing others to be in the semiotic, and like warriors when we're in the symbolic? Neither is healthy alone. It is necessary for women and for men to serve both ways. Kristeva says, let us know that an ostensibly masculine paternal identification, because it supports symbol and time, is necessary in order to have a voice in the chapter of politics and history. Let us achieve this identification, and let us in this way gain entry to social practice. What is a warrior like? She has entered social practice to fight for a cause. She is impassioned, ready and willing to destroy. She is able to objectify her relation to others. She is well trained in certain left brain techniques. She is hot, sharp. My vision of a prototypical woman serving like a warrior is something like a political activist, a lawyer, a Thelma, or a Louise. But Kristeva also says, let us reject both narcissism, which is what she feels is the semiotic can turn into by itself, and rebellion. Let us, on the contrary, refuse all roles to summon a truth situated outside time, a truth that is neither true nor false, that cannot be fitted into the order of speech and social symbolism, that is an echo of our jouissance, our pleasure, of our mad words, of our pregnancies. What is a lover like? She does not account for boundaries. Everything is for the other, the beloved. The connection is all. She is ready and willing to create, almost unable to distinguish between herself and that which she loves. She is right-brained, warm instead of hot, fluid instead of sharp, rocking crooning, not cracking. My vision of a prototypical woman serving like a lover is a poet, an artist, a gardener, a mother. It takes a woman psychoanalyst and linguist, perhaps, to show us that the word depends for its health and strength on the pre- or nonverbal, and that the desire for children is one utterly valid manifestation of the desire for the return to a state before the word, in which the vital activity, the essential activity of disorganization and rebirth can and must take place. The economy of heaven is surely neither capitalist nor separatist. It is change signifying space. For this heavenly space, we should perhaps be willing to serve like warriors, like lovers, like mothers, before Mother and Father God, angels, and all witnesses. Thank you.
I trust that all of you, as I did when I read Julie's paper, found many things, I think many significant things to think about. And I've decided to keep my comments fairly informal and in more of a teaching discussion kind of mode, and especially to give you the opportunity to comment and to question Julie on some of the issues. It seems to me that what we need to do now is to address the implication of what Julie has said to us this morning. I guess to paraphrase her question, what's a good Mormon feminist, and I would add male or female, to do now with Julie's paper? How are we going to somehow take perception and reality and infuse them in some kind of a redefinition of ourselves and really of God? It seems to me that what we need to do is to find some kind of a role, some kind of a model that exists both in the semiotic and the symbolic world. And at least for me, as a Latter-day Saint, I find this image to be really encompassed in Christ, after whom we supposedly call ourselves. I think that as we look at our individual and social selves, as we think about Kristeva Wittig and other French feminist notions of reinventing the self, this idea of rebirth through autobiography, through either a religious kind of confession or I guess a more contemporary psychoanalytical confession, what we end up doing is constantly recreating ourselves and retelling stories about ourselves. And I think this is what makes desire, where desire comes from. Roland Barthes, a structuralist, post-structuralist theorist, writes his autobiography, and it finishes up, and it's printed in his own handwriting at the end. And this is basically the translation. And what do I write now is the basic question. I have written my autobiography. I have, in essence, deconstructed all of my theories, all of my ideas, all sorts of images of myself, both linearly linguistic and symbolic in terms of photographs and so on. And Barthes answers his own question by saying, one writes with one's desire, and I am not through desiring. And I think this is the thing that pushes us toward eternity, and what makes sessions like this and symposia like this one so significant. It seems to me that Christ does indeed embody this role of creator, this role of artist. I see Christ as embodying both the characteristics of lover and warrior. And it seems to me that one of the things we can do that would be helpful to us is to degender these roles somehow. I don't know exactly how to say that, because it seems to me that Christ embodies parental, which would encompass whatever we're going to call maternal and paternal. Christ embodies this spousal relationship. and Julie has made reference to all the allusions to Christ and the church and the bridegroom and so forth and so on. Christ embodies the servile, this issue of the servant being the greatest of all and the greatest of all descending below all things. So both Christ's status as servant embodies also this sense of heroism. So we have the heroic servant, we have the greatest who is the least, and we have all these sorts of paradox. I think the notion of service is crucial, as Julie points out, and Christ, I guess, is the embodiment of service. And I love Julie's title, Service Like a Warrior, Like a Lover, as both of those roles. And I think they're two really key issues that we should discuss, and that Julie has brought up and helped me see, is this: first of all, this notion of service exists both in, I don't know what we could call it, maybe a temporal earth-bound sort of state, which we are going to call the symbolic, that encompasses languages and language systems and culture, which, as Julie's pointed out, tends to be phallocentric, logocentric, linear, focused on the masculine in terms of gender. And the semiotic, which partakes of these notions of heaven. Now, this idea of prelingual child is very old and very common in literature. Wordsworth talks about it a lot. Arnold, Eliot, everyone talks about it. But I think the one thing that post-structuralists can help us understand is that we need to do two things in terms of status and remuneration for service. Is number one, we've got to demand it, but at the same time, we have to defer it. It seems somewhat paradoxical, but we've got to do that. Well, why? In the symbolic, I guess we demand it. Payment for service is going to be extrinsic. In other words, the value of our service comes from a reward, whether it's monetary, whatever. It's extrinsic. It's outside. It has an exchange value, as Julie points out. We see it in economic terms, the symbolic language. The semiotic would seem to me, or non-language, would be more intrinsic. Now, the problem with demanding a heaven or demanding a particular status, remuneration, or whatever for our services, whether we're men or women, is that we become trapped in the symbolic. Any kind of remuneration is going to enclose. It's going to put a period. It's going to mark an end to things. It is going to limit us. And there goes eternal progression, folks. There goes dialogue. There goes everything. Because all of a sudden what we've got is we've got signifier and signified come together. Stamp it paid in full. Okay? And we don't operate that way. And in terms of LDS theology, Christ does not operate that way. His life as lover and warrior can't be paid. We can't stamp it. There is, what would we call it, a borderline, a wild zone, a gap, a space between the signifier and signified. And that's where jouissance is. That's where, I would translate it, bliss is. In that non-language sense, right in the middle, that we can't lay hold of, we can't name. Why? Because when we name it, we encapsulate it, we enclose it, we kill it, and it becomes pleasure. One translation is for jouissance. In French, since we're doing all these various versions of service, jouissance is in a sexual sense, coming. Just at that moment of climax, but it's not the climax. When you say climax, that's closure, that's pleasure, that is not bliss. And pleasure, I would probably say, belongs to the symbolic. Bliss is the semiotic, outside of language. So closure is going to trap us in the symbolic. The other idea is this notion of eternal progression and what heaven is. And I don't know about you, but this that this official notion of heaven really bothers me, and it this deferral sense bothers me as well. It seems to me that we can borrow from William Blake notion of, I mean, what the progression is. What I think we don't want to go back to prelingual. I don't think. I think we want to go to postlingual. In other words, it's not we're not going back to be a child, but we're going to go back as a child. Many of you have probably read Blake's Songs of Innocence and of Experience. Blake believed we had to have contraries, we have to have fighting, we have experience, but there's some sense of experienced innocence, and I think that's what Christ talking about becoming as a little child. I think there's got to be a post-linguistic, I don't know, I called it a semi-bolic, where we can maybe somehow exist in both the symbolic and the semiotic somehow. Because whether we like it or not, language is what we have. Language is all that we have. And I guess unless we're like Isaiah and has no sense of time and all time is everywhere present, and it really does become... it does become a signifying space. But I think really in practical terms, these are the kinds of redefinition that we need to do. Unfortunately, we can only do it in terms of language. But as a teacher, as a father, as a husband, as someone who in the church works with young men and young women, it's essential. It's essential both for the well-being of individuals, men and women, and it's essential for the well-being of the gospel and the church. And it seems to me that the key lies in helping us understand what it really means to take on ourselves Christ's name. Because I think Christ embodies both the symbolic and the semiotic, everything that we have talked about. Let's redefine ourselves as Christ is and degender ourselves.
If any of you have comments or questions, please state them as loudly as you can. I will repeat them in the microphone so that they can be recorded properly, and then Julie or Phil will respond. Yes.
I'd like to know if these two books that she referred to are available in bookstores currently.
Are the two books available?
Well, the Four Girls at Cottage City is a...
Four Girls at Cottage City is part of a reprinting of 19th century black writing. It's extremely expensive, but it is available in libraries. There's a whole series of these novels by 19th century black women. Emma D. Kelly Hawkins is the author of Four Girls at Cottage City, and it's an interesting novel, but I think it's much less interesting than Across the Acheron, which is available wherever good books are sold, by Monique Wittig. It was published in 1985, and it's fairly widely available.
Okay. The question is, you want Julie's response as to what her students felt were... Julie's response to her students as they confided to her, they were felt limited in their roles that were offered to them.
Well, I teach creative writing, and I think the person I'm talking to is behind the pole. Is that right? Oh, okay, there you are. Okay, all right. And my students write for the first half of the semester. They write personal essay to me, and this is always a terrific experience for me because it's with my voyeuristic desires are always satisfied. I want to know the deepest secrets of their hearts, and I get them. But very often I have the younger women. I'm not talking about the older women, but the younger women come to me and I say, well, I don't really, I don't know what to write about. So I suggest to them, what are you conflicted about? Do you have any conflicts? And they very seriously they say to me, no, I'm just going to go through school and work. And I say, well, what about marriage? And they say, I don't know. If it happens, great. If it doesn't, no. Well, this shocks me. And I really don't know how to respond. I encourage them to write about it a little. And I say, well, what about the idea that, eternal marriage is, marriage in the temple is sort of your ultimate goal? And what about that? And they really just blow it off. And I think it's that they're too young. And part of the reason that they're too young to worry about it. And I think part of the reason that I have written this paper is that I do see these really interesting attitudes about raising children, and I do have some single friends who want to have children, and I know of lesbians who want to have children, although they don't want a relationship with a man. And it raises the question in my heart, why do we keep wanting to have children, or why do we reject it? Why is this? It seems to me that the whole issue of having children is central to the feminist stance. It seems to me that if you're concerned about being a woman and woman's position in society, you're concerned about children and child raising. That whole issue is just a constellation of concerns. And so the question becomes, why should we talk about having children? And why do single women want to, what is this desire to have children? Phil was talking about this. So I don't really respond to them, in any way except write about it, write about it a little bit. What I hope is that they will discover they do want eventually to have children, but sometimes they don't, and I just have to let them go. What about you, Phil? Have you seen this at all? Have you seen this attitude at all in any of your students?
Let's just stand on the podium.
Okay. Well, yeah. Should we
stand up together?
Here we go. Well, I think not particularly, but I because the courses I teach don't. Not until recently, I haven't had a chance to encourage students to combine the personal and the public in discourse. But the problem that I see is that women are victimized by so many of our cultural institutions that I see have no relationship to the gospel. I don't know. Last time I saw Julie and her husband, we met in the temple. We were about to do sealings. And it was interesting the way she concluded her paper. It seems to me, as I thought about that and gone over the sealing ceremony and so forth, I just don't see any differentiation between promises and so forth and so on. And I think in terms of having children and parenting, I don't know, at least for me, it's as strong. I don't know. At least for me, it seems the desire is as strong in males, or at least should be, both in terms of the desire for family and to nurture and so forth. But the problem I see is women are victimized by institutions and expectations, and they need to redefine themselves. A good example, just a quick story. One of my very, very best students wrote an essay relating to these issues and had sort of an analytical side as well as a personal side, talking about her mission and how she was victimized by capitalistic, logocentric, overbearing priesthood holders who kept her out of the semiotic. It seemed to me from her narrative and her experience that she was on the edges there, but they kept wanting to draw her back into the symbolic, into the language. Look to the rules. That's something we've really got to be careful with. We need to redefine ourselves. And as I say, I think that it's there. I think in Christ it's there. We can redefine.
Unquestionably, and I'm. To repeat. Let me paraphrase. You're saying, Phil and I are saying that we need to degender our roles. But I'm also saying, this is what you hear. I'm also saying that we should have the desire to have children. So how can any new feminist theory, to get that, incorporate both of those? All right. Kristeva herself says in the essay that I mentioned, Women's Time, she says, until we theorize the desire to have children, we will not understand the full range of the feminist stance. That's what she says, and that's where I got that from my abstract. Okay, until we theorize the desire to have children, we will not understand the full range of the feminist stance or female desire. But she also says that the desire to return to the semiotic is manifested by the desire to have children, but it is also the place where artistic practice occurs. Okay, and so this, so she says, and there's a whole several pages that I didn't quote in the same essay. It's called Women's Time. It's found in the Kristeva Reader, edited by Toril Moy. If you want to put that on the board, that's another place you can go to find this. I'll put it on the board then in a minute. But what she says is that this desire, for a breaking away from the codification that is a result of the symbolic and father law, the desire to break away from that is manifested. She says right now there's such an outpouring of writing, poetic writing, and other kinds of artistic practices. And she says this is a manifestation of the same desire. I am not saying at all that we should all desire to have children. What I'm trying to point out is that there is a place that I think is embodied in and perhaps symbolized by the desire to have children that is outside of before or after or in between all the codifications that rigidify us and make us have to be servants without remuneration. If we can recognize those and give vent to them by breaking beyond codification, either by having children or by artistic practices, allowing others around us to be in a transformative space. That make sense? Does that?
Well, you can. I mean, you can. Well, you talk about rebirth for yourself as well. I mean, they're all analogs for, I think, the same thing. This desire to produce whatever it is, whether one reinvents oneself, whether one has children, whether one writes, whatever we desire, we want to produce. We want to produce. And in terms of degendering, all I'm saying is, from my position, which has got to be a masculinist, feminist position or whatever, I want to say that desire is parental. It's not, you know, I would think that men ought to be able to feel that same desire.
You know, I know this could go on, but we are at the end. Just a reminder, there will be copies of tapes available in the lobby of this session and also other sessions. Invite you to continue pursuing your interests here at the Sunstone Symposium, and I thank you very much for coming, and thank Julie and Phil for being here.